right about on legislative time. And ahead of committee time, on average. So we are going to, colleagues, just adjust the agenda to try to take care of one matter here at the front end. House Bill 3426 is the bill we're going to start with, so we can let Council Prinz get back to some other stuff he's got to get done today. So with that, I will open the public hearing on House Bill 3426 and ask Council for an update.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. House, and I thank you for doing this out of order. House Bill 3426 is a bill that was sponsored by Representative Barker, and the intent of it was to bring the statute dealing with a peace officer's use of deadly force in line with a Supreme Court case called Tennessee versus Garner, which is a United States Supreme Court case from 1985. And so we have, hopefully in your packets, I have provided you a copy of Tennessee versus Garner, a copy of the bill, and then a copy of the Dash 1 amendments. And I will say that I am working with experts in this area and trying to make sure that we understand, one, how far we have to go statutorily to comply with the bill, with the case, and then, two, making sure we understand that we're not going beyond that unless unintentionally and only if there was a good policy reason that the parties agree on. So that's kind of the background.
Okay. Thank you, Council. Representative Barker, do you want to speak to the bill? And then we'll call up the panels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jeff Barker, State Representative, District 28. As the Council said, all we're trying to do is bring the Oregon language into compliance with the Tennessee versus Garner case, and it is not intended to be more restrictive, to make Oregon law more restrictive than that federal case. We've come up with some glitches in the language, and we're frantically working with others, including David Lesh up in Portland, Deputy District Attorney Wayne Pearson, and I've been in contact with some of the folks from Washington County Sheriffs and so on. So we need to amend it. We need to do some work on this before we bring it forward for a work session.
Okay. Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Why don't we bring up Troy Clausen, Nick Armenicus, and Bruce Hoffman.
Mr. Chairman, to interrupt and follow up, I should say basically that the Tennessee versus Garner case, I think what everyone would agree, is that it involved a suspected felon who was fleeing a scene, and there was no, and he was shot by a Tennessee, Memphis, Tennessee police officer and died. The suspected felon that was fleeing, there was no evidence that he had any weapon or anything. And the case, the Supreme Court decided it on a Fourth Amendment ground that this was an unreasonable seizure of this person, and found that in such a case there would have to be probable cause to believe that the suspect possessed a significant poses a significant threat of death or serious physical injury to the officer or others, to use that use of force.
Okay, thank you. Why don't we start with Mr. Clausen, and then we'll do Mr. Armenicus and Mr. Hoffman.
Good afternoon, Chair, Mr. Chairperson. I haven't testified before, so please forgive me and my etiquette as far as...
That's all right. We'll be gentle with you.
Thank you. Appreciate that. I'm here today representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association and the 36 sheriffs across the state of Oregon, basically bringing, as the bill has been written or proposed to us, we are opposed to the language that is in it currently. We'd like to see the bill go to some further discussion to address some of the issues that we have with the language, and if the language could be worked out, then go forward with whatever is needed to be done.
Okay, thank you. Nick, do you want to go next?
Yes. For the record, Chair Williams, members of the committee, I'm Nick Armenicus from the Oregon Department of Corrections, Deputy Director. The Oregon Department of Corrections has concerns with HB 3426 as it's submitted. We are concerned that the bill in its present form may have some unintended consequences of restricting correctional officers in the use of lethal force in the event of an escape or attempted escape by a convicted felon in our custody. It is our understanding that there's other stakeholders and that we're proceeding and reviewing the bill and the committee amendments that have are in process, and we are asking respectfully that we have an opportunity to work with the committee and other stakeholders to address these concerns for the department.
Okay, thank you, Nick. Mr. Hoffman, I get a sense of where your testimony might be going, but let's see if I'm right.
Hey, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bruce Hoffman. I'm a sergeant with the Oregon State Police Training Section, and we too have some concerns with the wording on this bill. And if there is to be a work committee form or something, we would certainly like to be a part of that.
Okay. Are there questions for these gentlemen? It sounds like everybody's sort of coming from the same spot as Representative Barker so indicated. All right. Why don't see no questions? We appreciate your testimony, gentlemen. And counsel and Representative Barker will be communicating with you about getting your comments and feedback on any draft changes to the bill.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
Sure. Representative Jensen.
Could you indulge me and enlighten me a little bit on the issue on this this bill? I assume we're talking about a police officer and a felon that is fleeing the scene. The Supreme Court case said you ain't supposed to shoot him in the back because you're not threatened. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, that's correct.
Supposing this individual is someone that the police officer has reason to believe is a major threat to society, or to other people, even though at the moment the police officer's life is not in danger, what's covered under that, and what can the police officer do under those circumstances?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen, I think that the case would say that unless there's a threat at that time, an immediate threat of serious physical harm or death, that you cannot use deadly force if the person is not. You know, there's another issue with if they're causing a immediate threat to yourself, the officer, or someone else. But if there is no such threat imminently, then there is no use of deadly force.
Can I?
You may continue.
So does my wife then, if this person happens to three blocks down the way, see me and decide that I'm an obstacle in the road and shoot me, does my wife have a civil action against the police officer for failing to kill the guy on the spot when they had the chance?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Jensen, I don't believe so. I don't believe there would be a cause of action there. The issue, the way the Supreme Court saw it, is if there is no threat at the time that the suspected felon is fleeing, then it would be unreasonable to use deadly force before any, when he's just a suspect. And so there would have to be a probable cause to believe that the person had just committed that felony and that that there was a need to do that because of a threat of serious physical injury.
Yes, Representative Barker.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, the case, it involved a 14-year-old unarmed burglar running away, and he was climbing a fence and the police shot him in the back. That was what the Supreme Court ruled on. Had he been running from a serious assault or murdering somebody, I believe the law would allow him to have been shot in that case because he is a threat. Even though he's not a threat to the officer at the time, he's certainly a danger to the community. And so that's why we need to get all that clarified, and especially with regards to a fleeing felon from the penitentiary, from the penitentiary. Difference.
That was the issues that I'm trying to sort out in my mind on this, Mr. Chair. Thank you for indulging.
You bet. And if you need some additional assistance in counsel has provided us a copy of the case. If you want to read the case or get some assistance from counsel on any part of the case, I'd encourage you to do so.
Thank you.
Okay. Brian, do you want to come up, or do you just want me to? And why don't Mark Landauer, you want to come up on this as well? And I think I've got a note here that Tim Weaver wants to come up. Mr. Weaver, are you here?
That note is from me. Can't read my handwriting. Unless you have multiple.
Oh, that's on another bill.
Okay, sorry.
All right. Don't confuse me giving me notes about other bills. All right. So you two want to go? Okay.
For the record, Brian DeLeishman, representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations and the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. I'm not going to belabor the issue. We would like to be a party to the a work group. We have the same concerns.
Okay. Mark?
Mark Landauer, City of Portland, Office of Government Relations. I'll just say ditto.
All right. Good. Everybody making their record here. Okay. Kelly Skye.
Good afternoon, Chair Williams, members of the committee. Kelly Skye, I'm a legislative representative with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, and we just wanted to testify in support of Representative Barker's efforts to bring the statute in line with the constitutional law. We are consulting with a civil rights lawyer in Portland to get his views, and I would be happy to provide those to Councilor Representative Barker.
That would be great. Thank you, Kelly. Okay, is there anybody else here to testify on House Bill 3426?
Mr. Chair. Not testified, but just one point.
Representative Brzezinski.
On that case that has been given to us, I would just note to people who want to get a clarity on that, keynote 9, which is on page 2 of the decision, really sets out what the parameters that the Supreme Court was using for when deadly force would be acceptable in those situations.
Right. Good. Thank you. Anybody else? All right. We'll close the public hearing then on House Bill 3426, and we'll jump back up on the agenda. And open a public hearing on House Bill 2199. Council.
Mr. Chairman of the committee, let me get to my staff members. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, this comes to you from the Governor's Task Force on, I believe, driving under the influence, and expands the offense of driving under the influence of intoxicants to include substances that adversely affect a person's physical or mental ability to a noticeable or perceptible degree.
Okay, and we have signed up, and I'll bring them up in panels, if that's okay. Captain Chuck Hayes, Dr. Barry Logan, and Camilla. I'm going to miss your name, Carmel. Is it Sugar?
Pamela.
Sugar. All right. All right. Well, I tried. I got them both wrong. Usually I get one, you know. All right. If you want to give counsel your testimony, and then Captain Hayes, are you going to lead off?
I am, sir.
All right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Captain Chuck Hayes, the director of the Oregon State Police Patrol Services Division, and I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2199. I have written testimony that is being handed out to you now. I also have a couple of driving cases, some studies that were done related to this topic, and then also you're receiving a handout of some written testimony by Dr. Robert Julian from Portland, Oregon, who also supports this bill. My testimony is going to center upon what is happening in the state of Oregon, and first of all, I'd like to start out by saying that by revising the definition of intoxicant so that it includes substances that are other than non-controlled, so it would include non-controlled substances and over-the-counter substances, we are not in any way changing the probable cause for making an arrest for DUII. That does not change. The police officer still has to make a decision based upon driving, based upon the field sobriety test, based upon the level or the noted evidence of impairment at roadside, and then the police officer makes that decision as to whether or not to arrest the individual for driving under the influence. What is happening, since we started the Drug Recognition Expert Program, which I coordinate for the state of Oregon in 1995, we're kind of going along with a national trend, and that national trend is that we're seeing more and more drivers now that are using substances that are not on the controlled substance list that Oregon has established as part of our definition for DUII, which is contained in ORS 8113010. That definition includes intoxicating liquor, it includes controlled substances and inhalants, or any combination of those three. What we are starting to see now is that especially with the younger people, but it doesn't always mean younger people, that people are experimenting with different types of substances and then sometimes driving automobiles. Last year, 2002, we had 139 cases that were actually involved non-controlled substances here in the state of Oregon that were investigated by drug recognition experts, and we have 190 of those in the state. It's not something that is new to the country nor to the world, because there's 36 states right now in the country that have DUI statutes that include the wording either any drug or any substance that adversely affects a person's ability to operate a vehicle safely. We're, as I said, it's a growing problem in Oregon and nationwide. We've had a number of cases, as I said, and I'm just going to give you, capsulize a few of them here, as give you some examples. In Coos Bay, the police officers there have arrested one individual three times for driving under the influence of intoxicants, but yet only to have that case, those, all three of those cases dismissed because they found out that the substance was an over-the-counter cough medication that contains some ingredients that you'll hear more about that have the ability to impair a person. An OSP trooper investigated a one-vehicle rollover where a 17-year-old driver crashed his car, and that driver had consumed two bottles of Robitussin cough suppressant prior to the crash. Both of these substances in the Coos Bay case and with the trooper's investigation came back with something called dextromethorphan. Also, there's other ingredients such as ephedrine and pseudoephedrine that are also involved in some of these substances. We had a lady, a 44-year-old lady, that was arrested in Burns for driving under the influence after citizens saw her leaving a grocery store, appeared to be in a highly intoxicated state. The officer stopped her after observing erratic driving, and she blew a 0-0 on the breath test, and she, too, had consumed a number of bottles of cough medicine, and she tested positive for pseudoephedrine, which is also a non-controlled substance. In that case, for DUI, I had to be dismissed. We have an Ontario Police Department officer from Ontario, Oregon, that investigated a lady that had crashed her car in a parking lot of a Walmart after nearly hitting several cars prior to getting into the parking lot, and she also was using a non-controlled substance, Sudafed cold tablets. So a lot of these things that we are seeing, and then coupled with some incidents that have just recently happened, I think all of you are aware of the Aloha, Oregon teenagers. There were five of them that overdosed on chlorhexidine HDP. I have some of those back. I left at my chair, but I'm sure somebody will bring those things up so we can take a look at them. But these contain, the chlorhexidine and many of the other over-the-counter substances contain things that, when used in high quantities, high dosages, and used intentionally to get high, they can cause and do cause impairment. Sometimes can be fatal, as a matter of fact. So the chlorhexidine is easy to get, along with Benadryl, along with the Robitussin DM, and I'd be more than happy to pass these around if you haven't seen some of these. But the chlorhexidine, they refer to this as robo-tripping. And so you can go onto the Internet. They do it a lot now to look and see how many of these things do I need to take so I'll have the same effect as LSD. And so they're impairing themselves, and many times they're operating motor vehicles later because where they may be partying or where they may be using the drug, then they have to get home. We're also seeing something that's called a mini-thin, and I wanted to point this one out. This one I bought for $1.99 at a truck stop right along I-5, and these are sold over the counter. If you look at the back of this, it contains 300 milligrams of ephedra, and we've heard a lot about ephedra lately. It just was related to a death of a baseball player. And then it also has 50 milligrams of caffeine. So you combine the 50 milligrams of caffeine along with the 300 milligrams of ephedra, which ephedra is just a natural stimulant like cocaine or methamphetamine. There's six tablets in here, so by taking all six of these, you have got yourself an equivalent to a line of cocaine or a good dosage of methamphetamine. It's exactly the same as what it is, but yet it's legal to use. Here's another one that sells in a lot of truck stops and things like that, and it's called Natural Energy Formula. This contains 292 milligrams of ephedra. So again, it's one of those legal stimulants that people are learning that I can abuse this and I can use this in place of maybe my favorite drug of choice. So there are a number of things that we're looking at. It's, again, I think the importance here is that whether it's dextromethorphan or if it's maybe some of the other things that we tend to run into that are non-controlled, if they're used in proper moderation, if they're used properly, whether it be a cold medication, Benadryl, Cortisedrin, Robitussin, we're not going to arrest these people. We're not going to be stopping these people because these people are not impaired when they use it in those type of dosages and use it responsibly. The people that we're running into, like I said, is a person that's drinking three of these at one time, or they're taking 15 to 20 of these, or they're taking six of these when they're only supposed to take one every 4 hours. So those are the people that we're having problems with and people that are causing problems on our highway. I gave you a study that, if you have a chance to look at it, it talks about the hazards of diphenhydramine. And in two studies that were done that are world-known studies, they classified that when you use large dosages of diphenhydramine contained in many of these substances right here, it's equivalent to a blood alcohol level of 0.05 to 0.10. So, again, a teenager or anyone that wants to impair themselves or impair their abilities to, or act like they're high, they can go in and purchase these things. And a lot of national groups like the FDA, also the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration and ONDCP, the Office of National Drug Control Policy, they are now recommending that all states look at expanding their educational efforts in this area because they know there is a problem, and then also look at revising state statutes and also training law enforcement so that we can be better at detecting these people because they understand the hazards and the emergency that some of these things can cause. I think that by revising the Oregon definition to intoxicant so that it includes any substance that adversely affects a person's physical or mental ability to a noticeable or perceptible degree, we are getting in line with the rest of the country and we're getting in line with the rest of the world so that as these new drugs come along and new abuse of certain products that we have thought for years and years and years that these were fine and we're finding out different, well, then we can have some sort of an effect. It also is going to help us that we can start education, because education is a key to this. We need to, if we change this statute, we could start and work with, along with the Oregon Department of Transportation Traffic Safety Division, where we could start a huge educational project as well so that we could warn people about the hazards of doing these things. And I think, again, and this may be touched upon by the district attorney, but it doesn't change the probable cause. What is happening is that these people are being charged and arrested, and these cases are being dismissed because, again, it does not meet the current Oregon statute as it is now. That concludes my testimony, and I'd be more than happy to answer any questions. And if, with the chair's permission, would the committee like to see any of these substances, especially maybe these that they're maybe not familiar with?
Sure. Yeah, go ahead.
And none of you are going to take any of those as they come around, all right?
I did not tape them up.
I'm not sure.
All right. Is it Dr. Logan?
Yes, thank you.
If you could please proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Captain Hayes invited me to come down today to talk to you. I'm the state toxicologist for the state of Washington. I also oversee the impaired driving programs for the Washington State Patrol and the crime labs for the state of Washington. I've been a forensic toxicologist for about 15 years, and I have a specific interest in the issue of drug-impaired driving. I provided you with a copy of my resume and a copy of a study that we published last year that has some relevance to both Washington and Oregon on drug use, particularly in truck drivers. But it was represented to me that one of the concerns that the committee might have is about the impact of the change in law in terms of both enforcement and prosecution of individuals who may be taking legitimately either over-the-counter medications or prescription medications that are not controlled and don't fall under your current statute. In the state of Washington, for the last 15 years while I've been there, our law has been fairly broad and has made the crime of driving under the influence include a person, making an offense for a person to drive under the influence of any drug. As a result, we do get a number of cases every year where there are drugs that are not considered drugs of abuse or necessarily controlled substances that do appear to account for a person's intoxication at the time that they're stopped by a police officer. For example, in 2000, we had in the state of Washington approximately 2,500 driving under the influence of drugs cases. 16 of those cases involved diphenhydramine, one of the drugs that Captain Hayes talked about. However, only in 4 of these cases was the diphenhydramine itself arguably responsible for the person's evident impairment as documented by their driving and by the sobriety tests that they conducted for the arresting officer. Because frequently these medications are taken with other substances that are controlled substances and are frankly more significant in terms of accounting for a person's intoxication than many of the drugs that we've talked about today. So the bottom line is that even though there are thousands of people out there using these medications, those who actually become come to the attention of a police officer and end up arrested for impaired driving is a very, very small number of those. And they're typically people who've been, as Captain Hayes said, misusing the medication or taking it when they were very tired or taking it in combination with alcohol or taking it in combination with other prescription medications, which combined accounted for their intoxication. As a result, very few of these cases actually go to trial. So of the 2,500 drug-impaired driving cases, in fact, I can't think of one case involving diphenhydramine that went to a trial in the state of Washington last year. The prevalence of these drugs in the driving population, the study that I provided you was published in the Journal of Forensic Sciences last year, and it was an account of an operation called Operation Trucker Check, which was conducted jointly by the Washington State Patrol and the Oregon State Police, looking at equipment and driver safety violations by truck drivers in Oregon and Washington, principally up and down I-5. During the conduct of that study, 822 voluntary urine samples were collected from truck drivers. 4.5% of those were positive for sedating antihistamines, some of the drugs we've already talked about today. And 6.2% of those voluntary urines were positive for over-the-counter stimulants like ephedrine and phentermine. However, interestingly, even though those drivers had evidently been taking these medications, they were also being assessed by police officers for evidence of impairment. And although there were 37 people positive for antihistamines, 51 people positive for over-the-counter stimulants, only one of them was determined by the police officer as part of a DRE evaluation to be objectively under the influence. So people can safely take these medications without appearing to be intoxicated and facing the likelihood of an arrest and a subsequent prosecution. Additionally, although you're facing certainly a change in your law which would make some of these cases now a crime which weren't previously, our experience in Washington is that we have about 40,000 total DUI arrests a year, including our alcohol arrests. And when we look at the capacity of the courts really is a rate-limiting step, and only about 2,000 of these cases can be tried either in front of a judge or a jury. So irrespective of how many additional DUI arrests might be made under the changed law, if Oregon's experience is anything like Washington's, the courts are already saturated with these cases and it's not going to result in additional trials. In terms of the value of the broader law, I've kind of laid it out as being not a concern in a huge number of cases, but in those cases where it is a concern, it's a very real concern. One of the cases that I describe in my letter to the committee involves a woman who, after taking mega doses of a diet pill containing ephedrine, became delusional and crashed her car through the the Washington-Canadian border up at Blaine and killed two teenagers in a car that she ran into. Her defense in that case was that she was suffering a psychosis from taking too much of this ephedrine. And that defense was actually accepted by the Canadian courts where the case was tried. But even in that case, it was the defendant who was making the point that it was the medication she had taken, the ephedrine, a drug currently not covered in Oregon statute, that had caused her impairment and her involvement in that fatal accident. I think the law certainly encourages responsible use of medications. As Captain Hayes said, education is a very important part. The Washington Traffic Safety Commission has used a lot of their educational or public safety education funds to let people know that they can be affected by the prescription medication and over-the-counter medications and that they have to use them responsibly. It's also very important to have the infrastructure in place in terms of educated police officers who can identify impairment caused by these drugs to objectively evaluate the significance of the impairment at the roadside, and also to have trained forensic scientists, toxicologists, who can provide scientific and technical information in an understandable way to allay a jury in assessing whether the drug was significant in that particular case or not. So Oregon statute certainly has been cited as a model in a proposed national statute for, or national standard for, drug-impaired driving statutes, particularly your early adoption of language concerning driving under the influence of inhalants or solvents. And I would strongly recommend that you adopt the language in the proposed amendment that would allow you, in those rare cases where it's necessary, to prosecute people for driving under the influence of substances which are not specifically controlled. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Why don't we go ahead and hear from the last member of the panel before we open up for questions.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kamala Sugar, and I'm representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We're in support of this bill. I don't intend to belabor the point that basically, we do have cases we can't prosecute because the defendant's claim is that they were under the influence of something that was a drug but not a controlled substance. And I don't want to confuse anyone by saying that we're trying to make these drugs illegal. We understand they have legal purposes. Some of them are over-the-counter medications, and some of them are still prescribed, but they're not controlled substances under the definition that we have. We're not asking to change that definition. What we would like to make illegal is driving while you're under the influence of those substances. So it's a limited way to deal with the problem as opposed to changing other standards that don't need to be changed. There are specific examples of drugs such as Flexeril, Dramamine, which is a diphenhydramine, Ultram, which people may be aware of as a pretty strong painkiller. It's a prescription drug. We do have a woman in Lane County who has exhausted her addictions to controlled substances and has now been stopped for or arrested for tampering with drug records, but it was not a controlled substance that she was trying to get. It was Ultram. So her addiction to a painkiller, which is clearly not just a Benadryl, but it's actually a painkiller drug, is addictive, and she's driving while she's under the influence of it. All of those behaviors are still not protected, or people are not protected from her, I should say, under the law. So that's basically all I have. I know you'll be hearing from Sergeant Tim Weaver of the Newburgh Police Department, and I'm hoping that he has a couple of examples to give you specifically from his county. I can answer any questions.
Thanks, Ms. Sugar. Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Chair. Before anybody on the panel, but currently, DUI, I guess we'd call it a status crime. I mean, there's no intent required. If you drink alcohol and you are under the influence, you're in trouble. Same thing with an inhalant. Same thing, obviously, with controlled substance. We've got those fairly well defined, and intent or knowledge isn't even an element of the offense. I'm wondering, are we injecting knowledge into this? We passed some drugs around there that I've got in my medicine cabinet at home, and I know that I don't, none of them bother me. I don't know if Benadryl doesn't bother me, but I know that some people have responses, and it may not be consistent that it may they may have responses to some of these drugs that may depend on the amount of sleep they got the night before or what's in their stomach or all sorts of things. And I guess, are we putting people at risk of committing a status offense under circumstances, you know, where they've really didn't intend to do anything wrong, they didn't know they were going to have a response to a particular medication that they were taking. And I guess, I don't know, you see where I'm going with that? It troubles me just a little bit where we're extending it to that kind of, those kind of substances. If knowledge still is, not even knowledge, is still part of the, an element of the offense.
Perhaps I can answer that. Chair and Representative Shetterly, I think what you'll see, at least on a lot of these drugs, is you'll see on the box or on the label from the pharmacy, don't operate heavy machinery. A lot of them do have indications if you take a certain amount of them, not to do things like that. And we have someone driving like a 4,000-pound car 70 miles an hour down the highway. That's definitely a piece of heavy machinery. I also think that we all have, or many,
I hope we're
have
criminalized not reading the instructions in those boxes.
Well, but I think what we are charging people with is the responsibility that when they're affected to a noticeable and perceptible degree, just like they can go to a bar and have a glass of wine or go to dinner, but if they have too much, and it's subjective for each individual person, what is too much for that person? Then they're still charged with knowing that they're affected to a noticeable and perceptible degree, just like when they leave the restaurant, just like when they leave the bar. And the 08 standard isn't the only standard. And so for some people, myself included, an 08 might be too intoxicating. I mean, I would be affected before that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think this is the same standard, and I think it's fair to hold people to that standard.
If I could comment, too, I really can't emphasize enough the importance of doing public safety education. I mean, even if you don't have this as part of your statute, people are still going to be affected by the use of these medications. And it's incredibly important to make people aware or to change their mindset, not just to think, well, I feel a little woozy, but it's just the cold medication. But that should be a red flag about whether you get out and drive your vehicle.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative.
But so would driving with an inner ear infection, I mean, for instance.
Should that be an offense?
Yeah, I don't know.
Could it
cause the same kind of perception problems and I assume as some of these drugs. I'm just a little bit concerned about where we're going. I understand the public safety aspect of it, but there's an aspect too of criminalizing things that aren't illegal at this point. I'm going to let the committee weigh into this, but I'm just way out in left field.
Well, Representative Pruzanski, and then Representative Jensen, and then Representative Ackerman.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, question. I guess probably to Chuck and the Kamala. In prosecution of these cases, it seems to me, based on what I'm hearing and my experience, we're going to have to rely on a DRE. To actually come in to actually prove this up, because they're going to have to be able to tell, because they're not going to have anything on the, in most cases, unless it is some type of alcohol-based substance, anything that's going to be reflected in an intoxilizer. So I'm assuming that one of the safeguards that's going to be, and not even safeguards, just the requirement, is that we have DREs that are going to be able to pick up these signs and basically give a report that's going to demonstrate that the person was under the influence at the time they were operating the motor vehicle.
Go ahead. Mr. Chair and Representative Pruzanski, I would agree that we're going to have to prove it some other way than the intoxilizer. And I think absent confessions about how many bottles of Robitussin they consumed, we definitely will need to prove it through a DRE.
Well, Chuck, before you answer that, let me just go in there because, I mean, we have officers who are certified to operating the intoxilizer, and then we have different stages or levels for those individuals who go on for advanced training to get into doing certain type of tests, the field sobriety tests that are broken out. But, I mean, who else besides someone that's at the level of DRE is going to be able to give the prosecutor what the information he or she is going to need to persuade a jury?
Mr. Chair, Representative Prozanski. All officers in the state of Oregon now are being trained in the basic drug impairment skills. But again, what we're also recommending, highly recommending, is that if they get a case like this that could be something other than alcohol and maybe a Robitussin or whatever it might be, we're always recommending that they contact the DRE, the drug recognition expert. And right now we have 190 of those in the state, and we're doing another school in May, so this is continual training. If I had my way, every police officer in the state would be trained as a DRE, and I'm sure the prosecutors would agree, because those are the people that, again, that are highly, highly trained to come in and look for these levels of impairment to document that evidence. And also, the DREs are able to determine if they're not impaired, and then the report would reflect that, if it could be a medical impairment. Representative Shetterly gave the example of the inner ear infection. I think that's a perfect example, because have people been arrested for those kind of things? Yes, they have, for driving under the influence. And a DRE has come in and been able to tell that that is a medical impairment, and it's not an impairment based upon taking intoxicants or alcohol or drugs. And so those cases are quickly dismissed because it was determined to be a medical impairment. So the DRE is just a major component of this entire thing, and I have to say that Oregon is in the top of the country when it comes to DRE training, so you're getting some quality trained DREs in this state that can do this.
Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think my question or concern follows Representative Shetterly's questions and concerns, and that's the... at least for the layperson looking at this, the concept of the guilty mind, that the use of these intoxicants or drugs, as the case may be, or for that matter, the use of prescription drugs, which may do the same thing, and of course with the dosage on many of the prescription drugs is highly individualized. The doctor only makes some kind of a wild estimate at what the appropriate dosage might be, and some people react far more quickly to them than others. And so I have a real concern about the issue of I have no concern about some of these things. I drive up and down I-84, and I have 18-wheelers past me going 100 miles an hour or better. I certainly hope they're not on some of these or other drugs. At least if they are, I'm glad when they get beyond me, sort of thing. But I do have a concern about the issue of the guilty mind, that with mens rea, they use the
phrase. That's the phrase.
Wow.
Bob, way to go. We're going to get you your JD yet.
That's right. Well, on judiciary, does it take?
The issue does concern me, and I don't know exactly where how we deal with that. I leave that to the legally smart people.
Representative Ackerman?
Yes, I think... also within this open door is the issue I raised regarding the definition of an intoxicant, particularly as it relates to these substances we see here today, because I think you're only defining those as including but not limited to alcohol, controlled substance, or an inhalant. I'm wondering, for legal counsel, if that's not unconstitutionally broad or unconstitutionally vague. I think we should have, it's not necessarily a question of the panel unless you wish to respond, and I might not get my full answer today because I have to leave at 2:00, but I want to raise that as an issue because I might not know what you're talking about. Not you necessarily, but what the bill means when it says including but not limited to.
All right. Counsel.
Sure. Chair, members of the committee, Mr. Hayes, for example, on a alcohol, someone can take an intoxilizer, and you can distinguish between someone who's had one or two drinks and someone who's had half a dozen by the level of alcohol in their blood. Is there any similar test in which you could perform on someone that would determine whether they have had one teaspoon of one of these Robitussin as opposed to six bottles?
Mr. Taylor and Mr. Chair. I think that, again, if we're talking about levels of alcohol, it kind of, you can't really tell whether they've had two or three drinks or six drinks or 10 drinks because, again, alcohol affects people differently.
You can tell how much alcohol they have in their blood, right?
Yes, through the breath test, you can do that. But, again, that's not going to maybe give you an exact example of how many drinks. But in the case of someone that has taken, say, one tablespoon of Vicks Formula 44 or NyQuil or something like that, again, it all comes back to the impairment. Why did we get here in the first place? Did that person, were they involved in a crash? Did they cross over the center line and almost hit somebody? Then once they got them out of the car, how did they do on field sobriety tests? Because, again, we have to deal with probable cause. We can't just arrest people for suspicion of DUI. There's got to be some probable cause there, and we've got to see the noted impairment. If that was to happen, and then say there was a 0.00 breath alcohol breath test, well, then the DRE, as in Representative Prozanski's illustration, would be summoned to come in and do the evaluation to determine at the time of that evaluation, is that person impaired? And it's a very complex 12-step process that the DRE does, much like an emergency room doctor would do if someone was admitted into the ER. So we would be able to use that to determine, is the impairment there or not?
But there's no equivalent test like an intoxilized right now.
There is not. I'm sorry. There's no blood test. There's no urine test. That would give us quantitation. It's either the substance is either there or it is not.
Thank you.
Okay.
Chair?
Yes.
May I add to that comment?
You can. We are going to need to move it along, though, because there are more people on this bill, and we got a whole list. So go ahead.
I just wanted to explain to the committee and council that one of the tests, for an example, of the 12 parts of a DRE is the horizontal gaze nystagmus. I think some of you are familiar with the description of that, where the officer might hold a pen light in front of the person's eyes and move it back and forth, observing how the eyes move in a certain way. And with alcohol, for example, there will be certain signs. There are 6 clues. One of the tests that can be done for certain types of drugs, if it's a central nervous system depressant, you might also see a vertical nystagmus, which is when the pen light goes up and down. The eyes will move in a different way when someone's under the influence of that. Now, we're not going to say they're an 08 or they're a 10 or something like that, because we're not talking about alcohol. We're not talking about blood alcohol content, but we are talking about how impaired they are. And the eyes, that is one example of a test I can tell you kind of in simple terms, that the eyes will do a jerking pattern. I've heard officers describe it as being like windshield wipers going across a dry windshield, bouncing across. So that's an example I thought I could give.
Representative Shirley,
yeah,
let's
real
for the panel.
Briefly, your question about how whether we determine how much of a substance, let's say, is in the blood, raises the possibility of somebody with an inner ear infection who takes a teaspoon of Benadryl because of the pain or whatever the case may be, and then goes out and drives. Does that subject them possibly then to criminal prosecution now, where they wouldn't be, or under this bill, where they wouldn't be? And how do we know that it's the Benadryl that's causing the impairment and it's not just some sort of a correlative kind of
I beg your pardon.
No, I kind of was getting lost in my own question, but
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to comment on something that Captain Hayes said, and I guess differ a little with that. A blood test for the presence of drugs, a quantitative test of the blood, can help to differentiate between recreational use and therapeutic use of a drug. Mm-hmm. It's not absolutely dispositive of one or the other, but the information, if it's very high, certainly you can say that's not therapeutic use. Quantitative tests of urine are somewhat meaningless, because the concentration of a drug in a urine sample is as much a function of how much liquid a person consumes as how much drug they've taken. But a quantitative blood drug test does add to the interpretability of a case.
If I could add just one more thing, Mr. Chair, and this response to Representative Shetterly's question, too. Another example would be somebody that has an inner ear infection, but yet they've maybe decided to have one or two beers.
Sure.
They may register a 00 on the breath test, or they could an 01 or an 02. But yet, when you get a combination of like that, something that could be medically, but something at a low level of an intoxicant, that person could be just as dangerous as somebody that's a 0.25 or a 3.0. I would not want that person on the road meeting me, because that person has the potential of disaster out there. So we're hoping, again, that education and common sense play into these issues.
Mr. I don't want to be on record as saying I want those people on the road either. It's really a question of what we're criminalizing here is what I'm trying to focus on.
Representative Barker.
Very briefly, sir. Thank you. Captain, somebody is loaded up on that driving erratically. Would there not be, I mean, could you not charge them with reckless driving? Would that not be an option? I mean, other than obviously a step down because that's sort of inclusive in DUI. But.
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Barker, we can and we have. But we have prosecutors here that will tell you that I think that reckless driving many times is more difficult to prove and convict than DUI. Maybe I'm speaking for the prosecutor, so I'll let you comment if you'd like.
If they're driving erratically and it qualifies to the level of being reckless driving, then we'll charge it. Sure. There can sometimes be something that would not necessarily qualify as reckless driving. Perhaps it would be careless driving, which is a violation or an infraction. But it would also be driving under the influence of a substance. So.
Okay. Thank you very much, panel. We appreciate
you
being here, and Dr. Logan, appreciate you making an effort to cross the river and come talk to us. Ken Manili, Mary Anderson, and then I've got a note here that Tim, is this the bill Tim Weaver wants to testify on? Tim, are you here?
Yes.
Okay. All right. If the three of you will come forward. And do you want to go get their testimony? And I'm not trying to deny you your fair opportunity to testify, but we've had a fair amount of discussion, so to the extent you can consolidate your comments and help us move through our agenda today as quickly as possible, would appreciate it. Who wants to start? Ken?
Ken Manili is with me, Chair Williams, members of the committee. I am Dr. Emma Dutton, representing Oregon State Police Forensic Services Division. I'm the Quality Assurance Manager for the Forensic Laboratories. And Ken Manili is our technical leader for toxicology. I have provided you with testimony today, and I will summarize that testimony. This goes to show you what the laboratories can do and how we can support a DRE evaluation of somebody who's driving under the influence or impaired. We have procedures in place that can do urine toxicology, and these urine toxicology procedures, typically 80% of them can find a controlled substance. Of the 20%, there may be a negative result, or we might find a non-controlled substance. And in those cases, the non-controlled substance is often reported as to what that non-controlled substance would be. And some of those non-controlled substances have been mentioned here. Of those 20% reported with either no controlled substance or non-controlled substance, those would be the cases that we would look at to try to further define or identify what the non-controlled substance would be to help support the DRE officer's impairment or the DRE officer's acknowledgement of some type of impairment. Again, we do urine toxicology. We do not do blood toxicology at this stage, and therefore it is only an identification of whether the substance is present or not present. Of those 20%, the fiscal impact in having to work these cases can through to identify a non-controlled substance to support the DRE officer's report, the fiscal impact would be minimal. If you have additional questions on the specifics of the procedures, how the procedures are done, or the types of non-controlled substances that are found, I would refer those questions to Mr. Ken Manili.
Thank you, Dr. Dunn. Ms. Anderson.
Thank you, Chair Williams and members of the committee. My name is Mary Anderson. I'm a deputy district attorney with Deschutes County. I am testifying today on behalf of the Governor's Advisory Committee on Driving Under the Influence. And with the Chair's permission, rather than go over some of the points on my written testimony, if I could just address some of the questions that were raised.
Yeah, that'd be fine.
Thank you. One of the issues that was raised is, can we prosecute this crime under reckless driving? And the answer, the short answer is yes, but the long answer is it's available but not appropriate. When we're talking about people who are prosecuted for using over-the-counter and herbal medications that affect them to the point that we are having officer contact and intervention, these people are impaired to a degree where there is a treatment aspect that is necessary. That component is not available throughout the state for prosecutions of reckless driving. The DUI statute provides an appropriate mechanism for treatment as well as the opportunity to diversion. If we prosecute these people under the crime of reckless driving, it's totally in the discretion of the district attorney's office whether to treat that as a diversion, and often it is not. These cases would be difficult to prove, but the cases that we would see would be small in number and would be the worst of the worst. We are not talking about people who are taking a dose of medication to deal with a cold or to deal with allergies. We are talking about people who are abusing these over-the-counter drugs, these herbal supplements, to the point that they are impaired and should not be driving a vehicle because they are putting other people as well as themselves at risk. By not including other impairing substances in the definition of DUI, we are denying these people an opportunity to get help and to intervene. And I think that's an important aspect to remember. Reckless driving really focuses on a specific type of conduct that the person engages in. Driving under the influence looks at the person's condition, their level of impairment. The standard of proof does not change. The state would still be required to prove a person's guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. If a person has a medical condition that's causing their impairment, that is not going to satisfy a trier of fact, whether it be a jury or a judge. These would be difficult cases to prove, and the reason we're coming before you is because we are finding that some members of the public are quicker at finding what impairs them than we are listing it under the statute. There's many examples of how long it took us to catch up with drugs like Rohypnol, some of the soma substances. It is a general definition. However, the state would be required to specifically plead what the impairing substance is, and that is included in the statute. So it's not a free-for-all. We would have to prove what it was that caused the impairment. The only other issue that I'd like to raise, and be happy to answer any questions, is that I think there were some very well-founded questions regarding how this bill would affect people who are just taking medications. You know, these questions were also raised when inhalants were added to driving under the influence. I mean, that was a point. They are not controlled substances. They're generally available to the public. Oh, my gosh, what happens if I'm painting my house and I've been breathing too many fumes? Are you going to arrest me for driving under the influence? The answer is no. We're talking about abuse and impairment and misuse. We're not talking about taking a prescribed amount or a recommended amount of medication. I would strongly encourage you to support this bill and be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Weaver. Are you Mr. Weaver?
Yes.
Yep, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Williams. To the chair and committee, my name is Tim Weaver. I'm a sergeant with the Newburgh Police Department and have been there for over 24 years. I was certified as an instructor in standardized field sobriety testing in 1984, and in 1995 was in the first drug recognition expert class here in Oregon. Since 1980, I've been a contractor, part-time instructor with the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. I wanted to give you I came in with several war stories, if you will, but I'll give you just a couple today to illustrate the fact or some of the facts that we're what we're working up against. A couple of years ago, I had a case involving a substance called Kava-Kava. You may see this over the counter as Kavatrol or in its actual form Kava-Kava. This is a natural plant native to the South Pacific Islands. In the DUI arrest, the officer arrested based on some of the classic signs we would see in the alcohol-impaired driver. Weaving, crossing center line, narrowly missing a head-on collision, crossing the fog line, nearly leaving the road. Kava is began its popular upswing in the 1980s after leaving the South Pacific Islands into Australia and into the North American continent. It is not recognized by any government as a controlled substance and is easily purchased at natural food stores. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration does not control kava in any form. Consumption of this is by chewing a root in its natural form, or it's in a powder or pill form. Many times it's consumed by taking pills or crushed into a, made into a tea beverage. The effects of a person are relaxed inhibitions. Muscle relax, it's used to curb a bit of anxiety or to minimize some of the anxiousness a person may be having, and relaxes inhibition. In impairment or intoxication, intoxicated levels, the person becomes what an alcohol-impaired person might appear. The evaluation I've done here in the state was, again, very consistent with the DUII impairment, but and the evaluation 2.5 hours after the arrest I performed on the person, although lessening effects, they were still there. Crime lab, your analysis showed components and elements of kava in the person's urine, but without standards, we could, and certainly not controlled, we had no DUII case. We attempted reckless driving, and under some of the experiences Ms. Anderson has had outlining with reckless driving, there was no case, and the case went away. Essentially, the person was impaired, just as we would see an alcohol-impaired person. The second I would be very brief in bringing out, although I have several, is a case involving a driver arrested on a Friday evening with a 0.20 blood alcohol content. Two nights later, the same officer stopped the same car and the same driver with a blood alcohol content breath test 0.00. What we found were prescribed medications, not controlled, but prescribed. One was venlafaxine or Effexor, and also trazodone, which is an antidepressant. Not controlled, yet prescribed. I could tell you we could take the arrest reports from the Friday evening and the arrest report from the Sunday evening, lay them on top of each other, and they would match almost to a T. I'd be welcome for any of your questions.
Great, thank you. Are there questions for the panel?
Real quick.
Representative Brzezinski.
Ms. Anderson.
I'm going to take issue with what I thought I heard you say, was that if you had someone that was claiming to only taking whatever dose that their doctor had prescribed, if they have the classic signs that the sergeant has described, weaving, almost in an accident, the officer, are you telling me that you believe that your officers are going to make a distinction and not cite them and arrest them for driving under the influence and putting them through the DUII investigation?
No, I don't believe the officers would make a distinction. Their job on roadside is to make a determination if the person is impaired. The standard is to noticeable or perceptible degree, and they're going to base that on their training and experience.
Then are you saying, Ms. Anderson, that when you get the case for review, that you're going to make a decision based on the admissions that this individual said that they were using it within the guidelines that their prescriber had given to them, and not follow up with the charge for DUII?
Well, it would be on a case-by-case basis, but we would not expect to see the signs and symptoms of impairment with someone who's taking a prescribed dosage. Using your example and the hypothetical of, okay, the person is only taking their recommended dosage, they're taking it as prescribed by their doctor, and that can be established, that would make it a case that would be very difficult, if not impossible, to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. I think most, whether it be a juror or a judge, would look at that and say that person was taking the medication as prescribed to them. You may not be able to establish what is required to be established for driving under the influence.
If I can just follow up, but in that case, isn't it what you're going to be trying to prove is that their
physical or mental capacities were affected to a noticeable or perceptual degree, no matter what that level was and what directions they were following?
Yes, that would be our goal, but we also have to be realistic about all the circumstances of the case and whether it's something we can prove beyond a reasonable doubt.
Thank you. Anything else? Thank you very much. Next up, and I think our last witness, Kelly Skye.
Good afternoon, Chair Williams, members of the committee. Kelly Skye again, legislative representative with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And we do oppose this bill. Many of the things that I wanted to say have been said by members already today. This bill not only expands the definition of intoxicant to cover the over-the-counter medications that you've heard about, but it expands it to cover any substance. So this could include things such as insulin. We've had cases in the public defender's office where a person did not eat in time after giving himself a dose of insulin, and it affected their mental or physical abilities to a noticeable and perceptible degree. It would cover things such as asthma inhalers and, as you've heard, herbal substances. It's important to remember what Representative Shetterly pointed out earlier, and that is that this is a strict liability crime. DUI is one of the few strict liability crimes where you are guilty if you are under the influence and you drive. It does not matter if you know that you are under the influence. If you are under the influence, you drive, you're guilty. So someone who is taking an over-the-counter medication or an herbal supplement who doesn't realize that they are under the influence would still be guilty under this bill. The reason that that is important is because DUII in our culture today carries a significant stigma, along with the punishments that it carries, up to a year in jail, and on your fourth offense, it's a felony. It does carry a driver's license suspension. It's on your driver's record. It increases your insurance. It impairs your ability to obtain a commercial driver's license, and can cost a significant amount of money. There would be no distinction between the person who accidentally takes too much cough medicine and doesn't realize that it's going to affect them in a greater way because they're incredibly tired, or any of the sort of examples that you can think of. There's going to be no distinction on that person's record between that person and the person who drove with a 0.20 blood alcohol limit. That person will suffer all of the same ultimate consequences. So it is important where, if you do decide to criminalize such behavior, where you place it in the criminal code. I did want to point out that a lot of the conduct that we're talking about now is already punishable as reckless driving or careless driving, as Representative Barker pointed out, especially in the case of someone who's been caught more than once. If they've been caught once, they've been warned, they've been caught again, they most certainly can be charged with reckless driving. Or if they are caught, warned by a police officer, and the person admits to having taken too much of an over-the-counter medication, they are warned, they then know that it will be reckless for them to get behind the wheel of a car. Basically, what this comes down to is every time we walk near a road, we ride a bike on a road, we drive a car on a road, we place our own safety at the hands of every other driver who's on the road. And there are any number of distractions that can get in the way of a person operating a motor vehicle in a safe manner. Anything from a child screaming in the back seat of the car, a cellular telephone, they might be trying to take off their coat or change CDs in their radio. Those distractions can make a person very dangerous when they're behind the wheel of a car. And we cannot legislate good judgment. And that's the line that we're attempting to cross with this bill, is legislating good judgment. We hope that when people use over-the-counter medications or when they're too tired to drive, that they will not do that. But we cannot always legislate them making the right decision in those circumstances. And when you make a law so broad that you're trying to capture all those circumstances, you are likely to capture within that innocent conduct or conduct that does not deserve to be punished as severely as DUI is a punishment. And so we oppose the bill for that reason.
Thank you, Ms. Skye. Are there questions for Ms. Skye?
Okay. Thank you. We're going to... Well, let me check first. Is there anyone else here to testify on 2199? Okay. We'll close the public hearing on Municipal 2199. Colleagues, I've asked, just for, as a matter of inquiry, because I do think, as we've had this conversation on this bill, one of the questions ultimately that we need to ask is a clear question about the fiscal impact. And so I have asked that we at least determine a fiscal before we decide to take any further action or take any more of the committee's time, even on the discussion of the issues that were raised here in the testimony today. Next, we're going to go ahead and open a public hearing on House Bill 2620. And Ms. Sugar, you're signed up on that bill as well. Is that right? Council, you want to give us a little update while she's coming up?
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. You may remember this bill because we heard it yesterday, too.
Yeah.
but it was left on the schedule today because someone called and said they thought the hearing was today, and so we left it on the agenda. It makes a third conviction for driving under the influence of intoxicants a Class C felony. The defendant has two prior convictions in 10 years prior to the date of the current offense.
And Ms. Sugar.
Chair and members of the committee, the ODAA supports this bill, as we did last legislative session, and I don't really have a lot to add. I know that the chair wants to move on.
No, we appreciate you putting their support on the record.
Well, let me argue with her. No,
I don't know that they. I don't know that anybody testified on the bill yesterday. So
correct.
Did we have any testimony at all, or did we just tap it in? I think we just tapped it in. But we,
I don't know if there's anyone here.
But we appreciate you putting your testimony on the record. I think we've also gotten an email from the Pratts, which I'll distribute to the committee that came in today. Is there anyone else here?
No,
anyone else here to testify on 2620? Oh, well, come on up, Dick Kelly. You didn't sign up yesterday either, did you?
You know, Ms. Russell was here yesterday, and so I was under the impression that she had testified.
She may have testified. We had a lot of bills up yesterday, Kelly. You want to just put on the record that OCDLA opposes the bill?
Absolutely.
All right. So we know that the DAs support it.
Surprise, surprise.
OCDLA opposes it.
Can we compromise at 3.5?
All right. Good. We appreciate you both putting your information on the record and being conscious of the committee's time. All right. I'll close the public hearing on that bill. We did, as you recall, because we had such a heavy agenda yesterday, carry over a number of the bills on the schedule. So we wanted to make sure that if people had decided to come down one day and not the other day, that they wouldn't be foreclosed from being allowed to testify in front of the committee. So I do have now, colleagues, a bill with other witnesses signed up that I don't think we had up yesterday. It's House Bill 3250. I'll open a public hearing. And, Council, maybe you can...
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3250, if a person, certain people like a parent, grandparent, or guardian of a minor child may request a court order that would require someone to place a bond up if they were leaving the country with their children, and then there were some possibilities that the children may not come back. There's a dash bond amendment.
Okay. I will ask... Catherine Root and Laura Phillips, if they would come forward. And are you Ms. Root or Ms. Phillips?
I'm Laura Phillips.
You're Ms. Phillips. Okay, is Ms. Root here? Maybe we bored her in our previous conversation. Ms. Phillips, why don't we go ahead and start with you?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, and members of the audience gathered here today, my name is Laura Butterfield Phillips. I'm here today to urge the passage of the proposed legislation allowing our Oregon courts to identify and issue restrictive measures preventing the international parental kidnapping of our children. I'd like to ask that my remarks be made a part of the record. In 1975, I married a foreign student during my freshman year while attending the University of Connecticut. He was a United States citizen and was living permanently in the United States. We had two children from this marriage. Rawia, my oldest, was born in Connecticut, and Rihanna, about 2 years later, born in Chicago. I have included pictures of my girls, ages 3 and 5, standing together in 1981. I was a victim of ongoing domestic abuse, which included being punched in the jaw, requiring hospitalization. Because of increased threats to my children, including threats to break my oldest daughter's arm if she didn't fold his clothes properly, I left this relationship in Chicago and returned to my home in Oregon. As my divorce proceeded in the Chicago courts, their father made it clear through oral and written threats and assertions that he was going to take his children back to the Middle East. His first attempt to take the children in the winter of 1981 was made while I was visiting my parents in Kansas. He attempted to get the girls into the family car, but I was able to get the keys away and lock myself and the girls in the house. He then drove off with the car. He came to Oregon in 1981 and attempted to take our children while I was with my girls in downtown Portland. In this attempt, he hired someone to help him grab the girls and put them in a waiting car. Fortunately, the car was prevented from pulling away by a friendly bus driver and a taxi cab driver who had witnessed the incident and cut the car off. The Portland police were called, and he was finally sent away. On New Year's Eve 1981, he returned again with a Chicago court order requiring that I let him have unsupervised visitation with the girls. The Chicago court made it clear that if I didn't let him have visitation with the girls unsupervised, the Chicago court would have no choice but to award him custody. He was to have the girls for a three-day trip to Mount Hood. Months later, I learned that on the very next day, he and the girls flew out of Portland International Airport on their way to Saudi Arabia, where the Saudi Arabian government had assisted him with housing, employment, visas, and travel money. 3 months later, after the abduction, they had already forgotten their English, and my connection to them was severely limited. Governments are assisting with the unlawful kidnapping of American children. During the course of my girls' childhoods, I was able to visit them only once. And to visit them that one time, I had to have their father's permission to enter the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. I have visited my children recently. They are both married and have children of their own. My girls are captives of the Saudi Arabian regime. Because they are not Saudi citizens, they cannot obtain a college education in spite of the fact they were both excellent students and had great potential to achieve their dreams. They cannot leave that country without their husband's permission now. Women have few rights in Saudi Arabia, and education is not one of them. I have grandchildren, four of them, and to this day I'm not permitted to see them without patriarchal permission to enter Saudi Arabia. I have included the most recent information from the United States State Department on the conditions for returning child victims of international parental kidnapping from the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. It is almost impossible to retrieve a child from Saudi Arabia once the child is taken there. Saudi Arabia is not a signatory to the Hague Convention on the Return of Children. Saudi Arabia is a Muslim country, and its courts will not award custody of children to a non-Muslim American parent. To this day, I can contact my children by mail, email, and telephone, but it is extremely rare that I get to see my girls smile, feel their warmth, and play with my grandchildren because of this man's contempt and now the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia's contempt for our American courts and our family laws. According to America's Stolen Children Network, between 1,000 and 2,000 parental child abductions occur every day in the United States, yet there are no records kept on a state level, especially in Oregon, as to how many children are abducted internationally by a parent. Along with passing the legislation introduced here today, this and future sessions of the Oregon legislature should consider more detailed efforts to confront this threat to the welfare of Oregon's children. I have four major considerations for your review. First, in Oregon, the creation of a simple one-page form by the Oregon Department of Health, Bureau of Vital Statistics, to report the details and demographics of a domestic or international child abduction. This would start the process of tracking the numbers and nature of abductions in Oregon. This information would be used to help guide future legislative and executive efforts to prevent these unlawful acts. Second, the legislature should consider giving the court specific authority to refer an identified potential parental kidnapper to the Circuit Court's County Probation Department. Referral could include, but not be limited to, photographing and fingerprinting the potential abducting parent, holding all passports, maintaining all demographic information on both the potential abducting parent and the potential child target, supervising visitation, conducting home and field visits of both potential abductor and child targets to ensure compliance with the court orders, electronic or other form of monitoring, and coordinating efforts with the Oregon State Police, Oregon Department of Transportation's Amber Alert Program, and the federal government's Department of Homeland Security, Department of Justice, and Department of State in the event that an abduction were to occur. Third, education about international parental abductions is a major priority in Oregon's legal community. Of importance is to inform state and local law enforcement that a potential international child abduction is not the same as a missing person, that immediate reporting of an abduction should not have to wait 48 hours before efforts to locate an abducted child begin. Further, that it is not the American parent's fault for getting into this situation, i.e. blaming the victim, that child abduction is both a real form of domestic violence and child abuse. Fourth, the legislature should consider the creation of a new category of criminal offense, custodial interference by international abduction and or retention of a child. Currently, Oregon's custodial interference statute is little more than a slap on an abductor's hand. These people often rob their victims of a full lifetime of memories and experiences, and in some cases, deprive the left-behind parent of their child for an entire lifetime. The penalties for such an offense need to be greatly increased so as to be commensurate with their crime. Oregon must begin to prosecute these offenders, even if it is just a handful of cases. According to Mr. Kent Robinson, Criminal Division Chief, U.S. Attorney's Office in Portland, not a single charge under the federal international child abduction statute has been brought to date in Oregon. Oregon must send a message to potential abductors that the international abduction of an Oregon child will meet with the harshest consequences. And finally, Mr. Chairman, I would also like to refer this committee to some of the legislative activity going on in other states. I have included a copy of the bill currently before the Texas House of Representatives. Among other ideas, this bill grants the Texas courts great latitude to identify and regulate potential international child abductors. On behalf of myself and other left-behind parents, both here today and elsewhere, it is my hope that with the passage of this bill before your committee, we will set into motion a legislative agenda that will stop the hemorrhaging of America's children, leaving our shores at the hands of international child abductors. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Ms. Phillips. Are there questions for Ms. Phillips? We appreciate you coming in and sharing your very personal story with us. Anything else? Just so the committee knows, we had a bill. There are two bills within the committee that are very similar to this. We had an earlier one up, and because of a scheduling issue, we took the bill off the schedule at a time that a woman by the name of Christine Ullman would have been here in town. So she wasn't here. She was here to testify on the bill. The bill came off the calendar. She met with me and left me an article which was published, I'm trying to remember where. I believe it was in the California Bar Review or the California Bar Journal, which she authored along with some testimony that she had intended to submit. And I'll make sure that that article and testimony are distributed to the committee so you have an opportunity to read in more detail that information. The bill before us, committee, is a different bill number. It does essentially the same thing. The one change that would modify the bill in the Dash 1 amendments is it would remove the right of a grandparent to seek the filing of the bond. In other words, it would limit the ability to seek the bond solely to a parent, but would remove the right of a grandparent to seek the filing of the bond. So that just brings you a little bit up to speed on what's in front of the committee.
Mr. Chairman, did you also receive testimony from Lillian Fries?
I think I did. Yes, Lillian Fries from McMinnville. And I've got her testimony as well, and we'll make sure that that's distributed to the committee as well. So I'll ask Mr. Taylor to distribute all of that information. Thank you again, Ms. Phillips.
Oh, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Cromwell.
I do have one question.
Oh, Ms. Phillips, I'm sorry.
And I apologize for not speaking up sooner. But that one question is,
How is, I mean, if as in your case, the father was going to decide to take the children and go to Saudi Arabia, how would a bill such as this kept him from doing that? I mean, because I understand having to provide a bond or security or some kind of guarantee, that they would bring the child back. But if they're basically harbored, in your case, by Saudi Arabia, what recourse is there? Other than, I mean, I guess you get the satisfaction of keeping the bond.
Well, I think that if he had been required to post a bond, it would have been a financial hardship for him. It might have at least slowed him down. Maybe the courts might have recognized the need for continuing to supervise his visitation.
Okay.
Yeah, I think, Representative Crummell, the point you make is sort of one of degree. I think there are some people that a bond and the posting of a bond may not stop a person from doing this. On the other hand, there are some people where a bond at least gives some incentive to come back if you're keeping the child outside the territorial reaches of the United States, in particular to a country that doesn't and that hasn't satisfied or hasn't joined the Hague Convention, where they don't support any sort of and won't recognize a judgment or a legitimate process where a court would order the return of the child. And I think that's one of the real challenges here.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. I noticed some people came back in the room who may want to talk about this bill. Just by chance, you almost missed out. I was going to close the hearing because I didn't see any of you here. So I'm going to ask for Catherine Root, Sybil Hebb, and Rebecca, is it Gandy? Gandy, if you'd come forward. Why don't we go ahead and start with Ms. Root?
Thank you. For the record, Chairman Williams, members of the committee, I'm Catherine Root. I'm a licensed attorney in Oregon and a shareholder in the firm of Johnston & Root, PC in Portland. Since 1985, my practice has emphasized domestic relations and family law cases, and I have handled dozens of cases involving interstate and international child custody. I'm a past president of the Oregon Academy of Family Law Practitioners and a past member of the Executive Committee of the Family and Juvenile Law Section. During the past 15 years, I have been a presenter at continuing legal education seminars on various issues impacting interstate and international child custody cases, and I've represented clients in several cases that have involved an actual parental abduction or a genuine threat of a future child abduction by a parent. I am pleased to be here today to support House Bill 3250, which affirmatively provides that an Oregon family law judge may require a party to a case involving child custody, parenting time, or visitation issues to post a bond or to provide other types of reasonable financial security in order to secure the enforcement of those portions of a court judgment, decree, or order dealing with child custody, parenting time, or visitation. In my opinion, this legislation would be of assistance to parents and children in Oregon. If a parental abduction occurs, one of the greatest impediments to achieving recovery of the child by the lawful custodian is access to sufficient funds to pay for travel costs, legal investigation costs, and attorney's fees. In many cases, these costs and attorney's fees can run between $100,000 and $200,000. A bond that may be issued by a professional fiduciary can provide a ready source of funds that can be paid to the child's lawful custodian in the event of an abduction and used to pay for these costs and attorney's fees incurred in order to recover the abducted child. More importantly, if a bond is ordered by the court, the bond can also serve as a deterrent to discourage a potential abduction before it actually occurs. The use of a child custody bond has been supported by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And I believe that the committee is also going to receive written testimony from Nancy Hammer, who is the International Division Chair of the National Center. The National Center spearheads efforts to locate and recover missing children and raises public awareness about ways to prevent child abduction, molestation, and sexual exploitation. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children has worked for more than a decade to broaden the use of child custody bonds as a prevention tool to help provide much-needed funds to a left-behind parent in the event of a parental abduction. I was recently involved in a case that I represented the mother of a 5-year-old child living in Oregon City. During the trial, the investigative phase of preparing for the trial, became obvious that the child's father would request that he be provided a period of lengthy parenting time with his child in France to take place in the summer. It also became clear that the father had previously been convicted in France of abducting other children that he had from a former marriage from France to Ohio, and that the father also had a personality disorder diagnosed by a child psychologist and very few ties to the state of Oregon. On behalf of my client, the custodial mother, I requested that the court order the father to apply for and obtain a bond, or that he be required to deposit other financial security to with the court or with another responsible third party prior to allowing father to have any parenting time with the child, and certainly before allowing the child to have parenting time in France or anywhere else outside of the United States. Although I was successful in that case in getting the judge to order that a bond be posted, because domestic relations law is controlled by statute, and because some judges are reluctant to issue orders to require a party to take action that is not explicitly required by statute, if this bill becomes law, I believe that it will be of assistance to Oregon judges because they will be more than willing to order a parent who poses a general risk of abduction to apply for and obtain a bond. Accordingly, the legislation would then provide greater protection for children and greater security and financial assistance for left-behind parents. The bill includes a specific provision that the court issue certain findings of fact by clear and convincing evidence in order to support the ordering of a bond or other financial security or guarantee. This provision should limit the number of requests that are submitted to a court and should protect against most of the groundless applications, at least in those cases where lawyers are involved in the case. I have also reviewed the proposed amendments that were just supplied yesterday to me by Representative Nelson's office and are included in the -2 version of the measure dated 4803, and I did indicate a few changes that I believe the committee should consider making to clarify and improve the legislation. There may also be other improvements.
If you have the -2s, you are a step ahead of us. Because
and that's what we were out in the hallway discussing, Chair.
We only have -1s.
So. And this is what my whole testimony is based on, is the -2 version. So we're feeling a little bit awkward here. So I believe that Mr. Metter has the -2 version from Representative Nelson's office and was intending to distribute that prior to our testimony.
Okay.
So in summary, I believe that the purpose and intent of the legislation to affirmatively provide for the issuance of bonds by courts in these cases is of great assistance and would be of great assistance to the citizens of Oregon. I'd be glad to attempt to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Okay. Why don't we go ahead and hear from the other two witnesses, and then we'll open up. And I do apologize for trying to ask you to summarize as much as you can. We're going to be running out of time here, and still have a couple more bills we've got to work today. You want to proceed?
Thank you, Chair Williams. My name is Sybil Hebb, Chair Williams and members of the committee. I am a practicing family law attorney and have been for the past 7 years. I'm currently a supervising attorney at the Oregon Law Center's State Support Unit. As you may know, the Law Center provides civil legal assistance to low-income Oregonians. A large percentage of our cases are family law cases. The reason I'm appearing here today is that while I'm supportive of the goal and intent of this legislation and believe that there are many concerns that this legislation could go a long way towards addressing, I do have some concerns about the way that the statute is crafted. And I've reviewed both the bill and the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments. But I'll try to make my comments as understandable as possible if you haven't read the Dash 2 amendments. The bill as proposed would allow court to enter or to require a posting of security in one of three circumstances. The first two circumstances are geared towards a court's finding that there has been either a threat of violation of a court order or a previous attempt to violate a court order. The third, and I believe that both of those criteria are appropriate. The third criteria that would allow a court to enter an order requiring the posting of a security is set out by statute to include a finding that one party had engaged in a number of activities, which include quitting a job, terminating a lease, moving, requesting school or medical records of children, and these are all activities that are engaged in on a regular basis by parents in Oregon and are not necessarily indicative of any concern of a safety threat or a threat to abduct a child. Unfortunately, in these hard times that we're facing, we know that many of our clients and many Oregonians are unfortunately going to be in a situation in which they may be more likely to have to terminate a lease, which may cause them to have to quit a job, and then all of the attendant necessities of requesting school records or medical records and go along. And so very often that pattern of activity could exist for absolutely legitimate and just cause. My concern or my suggestion would be to take another look at the criteria that would allow or require a court to, the statute's drafted so that it would require a court to enter an order requiring a security and does not give judicial discretion, and that's another concern that I have. I think it should be left to the discretion of the court, but I think that the structure that would be most appropriate is if the court made either a finding that a person had previously violated or a court order or abducted a child, or a finding that a person had threatened recently to abduct a child, plus a finding that that person had engaged in activities that gave rise to a belief that the person was planning to abduct the child. And I don't know exactly what that list of activities should look like, but I don't think it should be limited to everyday normal activities that legitimate concerned parents engage in the practice of their lives. So I believe if there were sort of a two-pronged set of criteria so that the court could find that there was a threat and also some evidence that the person was either able or planning to carry through with the threat, then I would be supportive of the bill and think that it would provide some protection to parties and to children. Lastly, the second section of the statute give some guidance to judges in trying to determine how much their security order should be, and it lists a bunch of criteria, most of which I think is appropriate, some of which I'm concerned about, and specifically the subsection 3D sets out a list of criteria that would be a bunch of things that the court could find in the history of the party who was planning to travel with a child, and that's defined as marital instability, lack of parental cooperation, domestic violence, or child abuse. I have a concern that marital instability is a very undefined and vague term, and I think that could give rise to a number of claims or an undefined set of criteria. I think lack of parental cooperation should be limited to lack of unjustified parental cooperation or unjustified lack of parental cooperation, because very often in circumstances where there's been abuse or safety threats between parties, parental cooperation or lack of parental cooperation may be a safety tool. I'd also just want to make sure that those criteria were geared towards perpetrators of domestic violence and not towards victims of domestic violence. And I appreciate the chance to share my views. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hepp. Ms. Gandy?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Rebecca Gandy. I'm the staff attorney for the Oregon Coalition Against Domestic and Sexual Violence. I'll shrink my comments to I agree with everything that Sybil just said, and more specific for victims of domestic violence. Talk about the sort of the same things, but try to really quickly. My first concern is that there are not really safeguards in place, procedural safeguards in place for the issuance of this order. I understand that the Dash 2 amendments deal with a lot of that. My second concern is that the section that she was speaking of, factors that regular people might do when they're separating, things that they might do like quit a job or close a bank account, are very likely to be activities of safety planning for victims of domestic violence. They're likely to do this entire list. And an abuser could very easily come in with specious reasons of harassing the victim and say, notice that she has quit her job, where is my order of a security bond, just for the wrong intentions, and not, certainly not the intent of the bill, which I understand and agree with. And my last concern is, again, to the criteria for determining the amount of the security, that it basically could be used, we see, as a shield for domestic violence victims, that if an abuser was trying to flee with a child, that this might protect in that kind of a situation, but also could be used as a sword against victims who might be given a larger security amount placed against them because they are a victim of domestic violence. You are likely to flee because you are in danger, and therefore here's a huge bond that we're going to put out against you. So we just have concerns that this bill will impact domestic violence survivors in unintended ways, and hope that it can be redirected to more closely go with the intention of the bill. That's all I have to say.
Okay. Thank you. Both Ms. Gandy and Sybil, neither of you, though, really have a problem with what the intent of the bill is to provide some incentive for parents, particularly parents who are going to be outside the country in a non-Hague Convention nation, to allow, to require the posting of some bond as an incentive not to abscond with the children. Fundamentally, that principle you don't have any objection to. Am I right about that?
Speaking for myself, Chair Williams, and members of the committee, I don't have an objection to that goal so long as the court has to go through some finding that there's an actual threat of an intent to be inappropriate.
Right.
And so that's correct.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Ms. Gandy?
I agree with her.
Okay.
Yeah, I guess I forget that, and I don't know this area at all, but I guess that'd be the question I would have, whether there are constitutional limitations on what we can impose, especially on a U.S. citizen, on their ability to travel. And what the parameters that are present in that, you know, what can we require as a condition of allowing someone to travel outside the country?
And maybe we'll get the expert to respond. I have my own opinion, but I'll let you speak.
Well, Chair Williams and Representative Shetterly, this legislation is patterned specifically on legislation that was adopted in the state of Indiana and has been in effect for at least a number of years. I don't believe that it has any clear constitutional problem that a court can require orders to be issued to post this type of a bond, that would necessarily have a concern on a constitutional level. In particular, under case law in the state of Oregon that currently exists, the court can also order as a condition of maintaining custody or having certain parenting rights that again, linked to those rights, that
they have to live in a certain geographical area, and if they were to move to a different geographical area, custody could change to a different parent. That has been upheld by the Oregon Court of Appeals, at least in a case of Wiley and Wiley. So I don't think that there is an explicit constitutional problem here to allow the court to require a bond, again, as a linked to the specific issue of international travel or interstate travel with the child. Clearly, the court has to be careful about restricting travel generally, but as it's linked to this particular right, I don't think there's an issue there.
I think it's the issue of you can travel as much as you want. You just can't necessarily take the kids with you. We think there's a risk that you're going to not come back with them. And from a custody standpoint, I think courts do that all the time right now, whether
right.
it's in-state, out-of-state, or even to Klamath Falls.
I think that's where the parameters come in, I guess, under what circumstances can a court require the imposition of a posting of a bond. I think there must be limitations there. I would assume my wife couldn't just walk down to the courthouse and ask the judge to require me to post a bond.
Maybe.
Hey, I'm innocent. So what conditions have to exist in order to justify the imposition, I guess, of that kind of limitation?
Well, and I think that's where we get back into the discussion of the first and the second condition, where there were threats, that
right.
the court has to find
right.
the threats. Mm-hmm. And the third one that you raised, Sybil, obviously, is a bit more nebulous. If it's just that you've terminated your apartment lease because you're going to move somewhere else, that might be a bigger issue and one that we want to explore.
Although I have certainly been involved in cases that there hadn't been an absolute explicit threat or past conduct, and there was a parental abduction that occurred.
Oh, sure.
I agree that we have a difficulty here, and so therefore some type of conduct-based third criteria may still be appropriate, but I agree right now that the legislation, which again is based on the Indiana law, not that that means it's perfect or even that fabulous as a drafting tool, but it does imply the conduct. I had a client whose child was taken to Saudi Arabia where there had not been any prior threats or any prior abduction, and the child was gone, and the mother has not seen the child except in the embassy for 15 years.
This is very interesting, but I think that's probably what is analogous to prior restraint. I mean, what circumstances, there must be some sort of history in order to justify the imposition of a limitation. If it is something that comes in out of the blue, unsuspected, I don't think you can ever get a bond to limit that kind of an incident. So I guess that's the question I would have, is making sure that we identify what kind of history there has to be that's relevant to the limitation that's being imposed to justify that, because this is a prior restraint against a suspected bad act.
Representative Crummell, do you want to ask a question?
No.
Okay. You had that look. Okay. Thank
that
you very
questioning
much.
Questioning look, huh?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Last, we've got. Is it Matt? You want to come up, Matt? We've got Representative Nelson's testimony in front of us. Do you just want to put that on the record for us, I guess?
Read it?
Yeah, we beg you not to read it. Just
we've already got it.
Shall we just take a minute to look at it?
I did that. Were you this morning, yes, right? You were there?
I was watching on TV. Take a minute to look at it? Okay. That's good.
Okay.
I close it.
They come in on every day.
I picked up a couple of tips.
Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I appreciate the time today. I warn you, before I begin, you prefer I did not read Representative Nelson's testimony?
Yeah, I really would. We have it in the committee.
Okay, very good.
The committee will look at it.
The one piece of information that is on there that is not on your copy that is on mine is that she wished to point out that this abduction occurred actually in your district, Representative Williams. So this is a very local thing.
And I've actually met with the grandmother
right.
who came in and met with me in my office, and we've had that conversation. I do acknowledge. I think this Yeah, I do appreciate her pointing that out to me.
Very good. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there's also testimony from the grandmother, Lillian Fries, whose name is misspelled on the original copy of the bill. Our apologies. Testimony from Nancy Hammer of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and testimony of Christine Ullman. You'll find copies of all that.
Okay, good. So you're passing that out. I had some of that information. Did you also pass out the article from Christine Ullman that was written for the California Bar Journal? Was that part of the material?
The abduction risk factors unique to Islamic countries?
Yes.
Yeah, I believe you have a copy of that as well.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. Appreciate it very much, ma'am.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And we appreciate you abbreviating your presentation. Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3250 and ask the parties to discuss the issues that the committee raised before we take any further action. Colleagues, we're going to go into work session on House Bill 2174 and run Mr. Taylor ragged.
Chair, members of the committee, this bill was before us about a month ago. This comes from the Oregon Law Commission. There are two sets of amendments in front of you. Phil Lemon would normally be here, but he has his budget up before Ways and Means Committee today and tomorrow. The first set of amendments are technical in nature. They were recommended by Legislative Counsel's Office. For example, on page one of the amendments, you will see that it says commission may adopt by a majority vote all of its members who are eligible to vote. And the reason for that is that the commission has two non-voting members that are legislators, and they want to clarify that for the purposes of passing out by a majority vote, you don't have to include them. Then below, it removes statute and puts in laws because, as you will see here, we have a whole bunch of laws that are going to be hopefully adopted by the legislature, but that are not going to be codified. Below it says the provisions of subsection 2 of the section do not apply to amendments to guidelines adopted by the commission. That and this gives them the same power the Legislative Council has to renumber rules and things like that without having to come back to us on it. That's a dash 3. The dash 2 set of amendments, which are very thick, there is a provision in Article 4, Section 22 of the Oregon Constitution. Let me get it. I had inserted it and then it slipped out. Which states that no act shall be revised or amended by mere reference to title, but the act revised or section shall amended shall be set forth and published at full length. The rules of the Oregon Law Commission, what they do is after...
You mean the Criminal Justice Commission?
Criminal Justice Commission, excuse
right.
me.
Okay.
After we pass laws out of here that amend or criminal law statutes or adopt new criminal law statutes, they change their regulations to conform to those statutes, and then they come back to us in the next session for our approval. There is a court case before the Oregon Court of Appeals that calls into question this procedure, and they're citing Article 4, Section 22. The Attorney General's office believes that they will win the case. Nonetheless, if they're wrong, we're out of session. We may be coming back into special session because our whole system of sentencing, a substantial part of it, would be invalid. So to be safe, what they have done is, the second part of the bill is they have incorporated all of their regulations for the purposes of the legislature adopting it. Mr. Chair, the regular part of the bill is, as I said earlier, that part after last session when we enacted new laws or amended current laws and they changed their regulations in keeping. That's what the first part is.
Mr. Chair. Representative Brzezinski.
Do you want to take these in separate motions, I assume?
Yeah, I think that that makes sense.
Then I'll start with the dash twos.
Okay.
And make a motion that we amend the House Bill 2174 with the dash two amendments.
Representative Brzezinski moves that we adopt the dash two amendments to House Bill 2174. Is there discussion? Any objection? The amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I now move to adopt the dash threes in the House Bill 2174.
Representative Brzezinski moves the adoption of the dash three amendments to House Bill 2174. Is there discussion?
Any objection? The dash threes are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I have moved House Bill 2174 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Krasanski, if you could pause just momentarily. Well, this bill has
a subsequent
referral to Ways and Means. I think it probably has a Ways and Means on it, because when someone sees this long list of rules that was originally on the bill, they might assume that this is something new.
Okay.
It's going to be my preference, I think, to take the motion first that we vote to rescind the subsequent referral. And if the Speaker's office disagrees with us on that, they can deny it, and we'll treat it differently. But I don't see, with these small changes and essentially the codification of rules that have already been adopted, that there's any reason why this should have to go to the Ways and Means Committee. So can I amend your motion?
You may.
Amend your motion. So Representative Krasanski moves that we rescind the subsequent referral on House Bill 2174 that would have sent the bill to Ways and Means. Is there any discussion on his motion to rescind the referral? Hearing none, the referral is rescinded subject to approval by the Speaker. And now Representative Krasanski moves the amended version of House Bill 2174 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on that motion? Hearing none. Ann, would you call the roll?
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Excused.
Representative Cromwell?
I guess.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Krasanski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
He's excused.
Chair Williams?
I'm an aye. And Representative Jensen? We're moving House Bill 2174 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. Do you want to vote?
Aye.
And do you want, okay, state your vote.
Aye.
He votes aye. All right. House Bill 2174 moves to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Jensen.
Is that with the dash three?
That's with both the adoption of the dash twos and threes.
Yes.
It is. Carrier?
I'll do it.
You want to do it, boy?
Sure.
Okay. All right. Good. Representative Krasanski will carry. All right. We're going to do a work session on House Bill 2237. Council.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2237 comes to you from the request of Governor Kulongowski from the Department of Public Safety, and it prohibits subordinate public safety standards and training in the Department of Public Safety standards and training from disclosing a photograph of a public safety officer without written consent of the officer while being the officer's employer. You have a set of amendments in front of you, which I'm just trying to find.
Dash
twos. And I believe they supersede the dash one. And you have Scott Tye here from Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and I understand talking to the interested parties that there's general agreement with the amendments, and there are no reservations with the bill. I see Brian DeLashmet shaking his head saying yes.
Okay. Do we have any questions for Mr. Tye? Representative Jensen, do you want Mr. Tye from DPSSD to come forward?
I just have a question.
Okay.
If I can on this. I don't see a... oh, yes, I do. A corrections officer is included in. That was my question. I beg your pardon.
All right. So we have the dash twos for 2237 in front of us.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Krasanski.
Move the dash twos to House Bill 2237 under the bill.
Representative Krasanski moves the dash two amendments to House Bill 2237. Is there discussion on the motion? Objection?
Yes.
Was
this a motion on the bill or the amendment?
This was a motion to adopt the amendment.
Okay, so I have a question about the bill.
Okay. All right. So the motion is to adopt the dash two amendments to the bill. Any further discussion? Any objection? The dash twos are in. Representative Shetterly.
The only question I had, we're amending the statute in Chapter 181, I assume that's the BPSST statute. We're not amending this under the public records law.
No.
Was that intentional? I mean, normally something like relating to personnel records or employee records would be in Chapter 192, I would think. But it's okay. I mean, it's just an observation that it seems a...
That we're putting in a part of 181, yeah. Is that your point?
Mm-hmm. And not in 192, since... I mean, I know in 182 there's a specific statute, for instance, dealing with requests for information, personnel records, and those kinds of things. I'm fine with it. I just wanted to observe that we were creating an exemption to the public records law, I suppose, in a chapter other than Chapter 192. I'm fine with it.
Well, you guys have a thought about that? You don't have to pretend you do if you don't. I mean, if you have one, you can. Come on up and identify yourself on the record.
Alan Sharn, Deputy Director of DPSST.
Hi, Alan.
Chair Williams and members of the committee, in drafting this legislation, Legislative Council determined that it wasn't necessary to change any language in the public records law.
Okay. Does that satisfy you?
We always do what LC said.
Brian?
Mr. Chair, Brian DeLeish from Oregon Council of Police Associations. Maybe I can shed a little light on this. Actually, I believe in the public records section we did amend this. I don't believe it was last session. I think it was the session before, and it dealt with the ability to access the personnel records of public safety officers. Right. So I think that was already covered.
So now it's divided between Chapter 181 and Chapter 192?
I think actually 180, excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, again with limited knowledge here, but I believe that this actually establishes a pretty similar prohibition under the 181 as was already in 192. As far as the public access to the records.
Okay. Not all of us are as concerned about the chapter placement of certain legislation as Representative Shetterly, who hopes to someday be an indexer for the ORS.
No.
In a future life.
If I want to know about access to a public agency record, it's nice to know that I can look in Chapter 192 and find the rules and not have to look through every other chapter just to see if there might be some extraneous rule that's not covered in 192.
And I'm teasing you. It is actually a valid point, and it would be interesting, and maybe we can ask who did the drafting on this, do you know? Was it
Virginia?
I think it was Virginia. Maybe Virginia can get in touch with you. Okay. All right. So the motion, is there a motion? I don't think we've had a motion yet.
Oh, it's
a motion. All right. Representative Przanski
moves House Bill 2237 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Przanski moves House Bill 2237 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. I think I said that once. Is there any further discussion? All right. And call the roll.
Representative
Foster? Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Szymanski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. Okay. House Bill 2237, as amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And maybe we'll let our public safety officer, who has probably had lots of people request his photograph over the years because he's so darn handsome, carry the bill.
I'll take it.
All right. Representative Przanski?
Yes.
Tell me the number of the bill of yours, because
we have two bills. 2732, which is the one that was scheduled for public hearing and work session, and then 2733 we heard yesterday. I have a -1 amendment clarifying the issue that we had last night, so they're ready to go.
All right, so why don't we open up a public hearing on the first one, 2732, which we have not heard up till now. Is that right?
That is correct.
All right, so I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2732 and ask Representative Przanski to address us.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Floyd Przanski, House District 8. 2732 is the second bill I was discussing last night that you'd be seeing today. What I have passed, what is being passed out to you now is testimony from a private citizen who lives in Eugene, who actually, incidentally, is also a state police officer. I'm going to spare you from me reading his testimony. and just say that basically he has grave concerns as a law enforcement officer when you see that agencies are becoming reliant on revenue from traffic citations to fund police officers, and he goes specifically into the issues that we discussed last night as to his concerns. I purposely left his name off of this because I believe in, let's say, professional courtesy, even though he can be here as an individual, because his experiences are as a trooper, that is not something that needs to be put on the record. If any of you would like that information, I would be glad to share that with you. There is another individual who is with the state police as well, who has also emailed me that I've worked with for over the last, started working with him in 1991, and in his email he says, the problem, as you are very well aware, when law enforcement uses traffic citation venue revenue to fund positions, it is no longer about transportation safety, but it's about writing as many tickets as you can to keep your job and all the fancy equipment it supports. This is an issue that has come to light, and we have actually, letters to the editor that have appeared in the Register Guard regarding the situation at hand, and I also have an individual who I work with on the police commission who is actually a law student at the University of Oregon Law School who was cited in this scenario. I did talk to, if you remember, Justice of the Peace and Municipal Court Judge Jad Limhouse, who was before us previously on some other bills. He stated that what he knows that is happening in this particular situation, they are, in fact, having their officers go out of county. They're going into Linn County, citing and doing the violation in Linn County, which puts them into that other component that we talked about in the second bill that I have the amendment for, and then under that justification, bringing them into the municipal court. And so he told me that I was at the liberty to tell him that, tell you that he does support the changes that will be coming for House Bill 2733, and he also believes that municipal courts should be limited to the jurisdiction that they have under the city statutes and the are under the statutes for city jurisdiction. So that is the House Bill 2732. What this basically does is it will limit the distribution scheme. If you have a municipal court officer citing outside of his jurisdiction, that jurisdiction will not receive a portion of the fine which they currently do receive.
Right. So right now, basically, you could cite out of the jurisdiction, and if you run it through your jurisdiction's court, they get a higher kick.
They get half of the ticket.
Mm-hmm. Right. But if it's outside the jurisdiction, under this, it would go to the
to the state.
They could still cite it into their court potentially. I guess maybe not after we deal with the next bill.
That's correct.
But at least taking this bill in its abstract place, they could still cite it into their court, but the money wouldn't necessarily go to their court. The obligation would be payable to the state or the other jurisdiction that they should have cited it into.
That's correct.
All right. Representative Barker.
Thank you. In reading this, the state police officer is saying that it is bad for police to be able to create money for their department by writing tickets.
That's correct.
So there's a bill. Are you aware there's a bill coming out that for the state police that they can make more money by writing more tickets?
Well, the state police can
change the formula so they actually get paid more for writing.
Yeah,
money.
Well, that is a different thing. That is a formula that we would decide on a policy. State police in this state can enforce the law anywhere within the state, and they can cite them, and they would be within their jurisdiction. We are not attempting to limit the enforceability of the laws. We're just saying that when you have agencies that are actually using this as a profit-making. And the reason I brought this forward is because the grave concern I have in working in law enforcement and dealing with many different area law enforcement agencies, they are livid as to what's happening because they believe it gives a black eye to law enforcement in general by having this type of approach of funding organizations.
That's my concern. I believe it would have the same effect if the state police are able to generate revenue by if we change the policy. Also, if I may, Mr. Chair, some of this may be taken care of. There was a law changed a few years back when Chief Paul Arotola of Jordan Valley was making $100,000 a year with his $2,000 radar gun over in right on the border of Idaho.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I remember
Jordan
that.
Valley.
Yeah, it was Jordan Valley, the old Jordan Valley case. Yeah, I remember that story.
I went to the State Police Academy with that guy before he found police work was far more profitable working for Jordan Valley. But anyway, so there are some laws that restrict that already.
That story was a great story. Okay, any other questions? Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, has the League of Oregon Cities by any chance, or the Associated Oregon Counties by any chance, taken a stance on this as being preemptive towards their ability to raise revenues?
No, they have not. And this people, the individuals have spoken with either with the cities, individual cities, or and I can't say that they represent the league as a whole, have not had issues with it. They understand and accept that municipal court jurisdiction is limited to being within their jurisdiction. There was an exception for venue, and it was more for convenience. That's why I think Jad Limhouse gave me permission to come forward today, and his role as either a municipal court judge or as a JP judge, he believes that this is something that is appropriate because there were the intent of the legislature to limit jurisdictions of those courts. The county courts, they're not going to be impacted. I mean, they basically have the same jurisdiction, and they can side into either JP court if they have one, or into the circuit court, and it will not have any impact on the formula that they operate under.
Okay. And your old jurisdiction of Wilsonville is okay still, Representative Crummell, because that I-5 freeway just runs right down the middle of that city.
Yes, it does.
And they can enforce all they want.
Right. Okay, thank you. Anybody else here to testify on this bill, House Bill 2732? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2732.
Mr. Chair, should I come around to make the motion? Or?
Oh, you know what? You stay there and somebody will make it for you.
So move.
All right. Representative Anderson moves House Bill 2732 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? All right. Hearing none. Ann, do you want to call the roll when you're done helping Representative Shetterly?
Representative Parker.
Hi.
Representative Jensen.
Jensen's excused.
Representative Crummell.
Aye.
Representative McPherson.
Excused.
Representative Krasonski.
Aye.
Representative Shetterly.
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson.
Aye.
He's excused.
Chair Williams.
Aye. House Bill 2732 moves forward with due pass recommendation. You want to carry all these, Floyd, or do you want to spread the wealth?
I'll carry them.
All right. Yeah. Okay. All right.
I'll make it brief.
You better carry the next one.
Then we're going to open we did a public hearing on 2733, so I'm just going to open a work session on House Bill 2733.
Mr. Chair, you should have in front of you the dash ones for 2733. This is a fix of what we discussed last night based on the discussions and, let's say, the difference of interpretation. What we're doing is when you get down to line 13 of the bill, the language will stay the same from line 13 and through line 15 up until you get to the end of the first ORS, which is 51.050. Then we will be deleting the next ORS, picking up with the language again, and then deleting on 16 and 17 as the dash amendment says. So when you get to line 15 after the ORS, if you take the dash ones, it will basically read after the 51.050 that limits the jurisdiction of the justice court to offenses committed within the county in a justice court. What this specifically will do, it will take out the opportunity of citing the cases directly into a municipal court when a violation has occurred in a county other than where the municipal court is located. So we are taking the municipal court out of it as a position or a convenience, and it will say that if a violation proceeds in a county other than where the violation occurs, it can only go into one of two courts, either into the circuit court or into a justice court, and it just removes the municipal court out of that scenario, which will take care of the issue that we are finding on I-5.
Representative Shetterly.
Does that still leave a problem for West Salem? West Salem is in the municipal boundaries of Salem, but it's in Polk County.
Right.
And if I read this, it would say then if a violation proceeding is commenced in a county other than the county in which the violation was committed, so let's say Polk County, proceeding may be commenced in a circuit court or et cetera.
limits
this court. Can you still file it in Salem Municipal Court with this amendment?
There may be a problem. Because that one basically will say if it commences in another county.
Polk and Marion, but both within Salem city limits.
Is West Salem within the city limits of Salem?
Yeah.
So that's the municipal court.
That's right.
All right. Councilor.
Isn't it taken care of on line 12, the bold language of the current bill, a violation proceeding is commenced in a county in which a violation was committed? The proceedings may be commenced in a circuit court or justice court of the county, or if the violation was commenced within a city, in a municipal court. So West Salem is part of Salem, so it could be commenced in the municipal court.
It's
line 10 that hangs us up.
Yeah, that's the county in which it's committed. If you get to where you're within the same city in a different county, you have trouble citing the West Salem folks into the municipal court. Well, I was really gonna find out who you agreed to get this Dash One amendment overnight so fast, but you know, sometimes you get what you pay for, Floyd.
I got exactly what I paid for, unfortunately.
All right. Well, why don't we let Representative Prozanski work on his take-home bill?
That's right.
and go back.
My highway traveling bill.
All right.
In the meantime, be careful traveling down around Coburg.
Yeah, we're gonna close the.
Sorry.
We're gonna close the work session on House Bill 2733, I think, committee, that concludes our agenda for the afternoon. Thank you, everyone, for your hard work. We're adjourned.
Sorry, Floyd.